will spend the first few lectures gathering together information on the conditions that are necessary in order for agriculture to thrive. We will then be able to draw conclusions for the actual practice of agriculture, conclusions that should be put into practice and that only have meaning in practice. Thus, in these first lectures, we will have to study how the products of agriculture actually come into existence and what part they play in the world as a whole. Now, a farm comes closest to its own essence when it can be conceived of as a kind of independent individuality, a self-contained entity. In reality, every farm ought to aspire to this state of being a self-contained individuality. This state cannot be achieved completely, but it needs to be approached. This means that within our farms, we should attempt to have everything we need for agricultural production, including, of course, the appropriate amount of livestock. From the perspective of an ideal farm, any fertilizers and so forth that are brought in from outside would indeed have to be regarded as remedies for a sickened farm. A healthy farm would be one that could produce everything it needs from within itself. We shall see in a moment why this is so. As long as the essential being and reality of things is not taken into account, but only their outer material aspect, it is quite understandable that people believe it makes no difference whether farmers get their cow manure from the neighbor's farm or from their own farm. As I said, these things cannot be strictly implemented, but if we want to organize things appropriately, we must still realize how necessary it is for a farm to be self-contained. This assertion will acquire a certain justification. If we look on the one hand at the earth from which our agriculture springs, and on the other hand, at what influences the earth from outside. People nowadays tend to talk very abstractly about outside influences on the earth. They are aware that the sun's light and warmth and everything meteorologically related to these are connected in some way to the condition of a crop-producing soil. But present-day ideas cannot properly explain this because they do not penetrate to the realities, to the real facts. Let us begin today from the point of view that takes the soil as the foundation of agriculture, and then later we will also look at things from other points of view. We usually think of the soil, which I'm going to indicate here with this line, as being something purely material, with organic matter coming into it only incidentally to the extent that humus develops or manure is applied. That the soil might contain not only this sort of life, but also an inherent plant-like vitality and even something of the nature of soul qualities, this is not even conceived of, much less accepted as a fact. And if we go even further and see how this inner life of the soil, in terms of its fine dosages, I would like to say, is quite different in summer than in winter, we then get into domains that are of tremendous significance for practical life, but which at present are not taken into account at all. Indeed, if we take the soil as our point of departure, we will have to recognize that the soil functions as a kind of organ within the organism that reveals wherever in nature there is growth. The soil is a real organ, an organ we might want to compare to the human diaphragm. We get a proper idea of what is present there if we picture that certain organs in a human being are located above the diaphragm, especially the head and everything that provides for the head through respiration and circulation, while others are located below it. The comparison is not quite exact, but for purposes of illustration, it is good enough. If we compare the soil to a human diaphragm, we then have to say that the head of the individuality in question is underground, and that we and all our farm animals are living in its belly. Everything above ground actually belongs to the bowels of this, we can say, agricultural individuality. When we walk around a farm, we are actually walking through its belly, and the plants are growing up into its belly. This individuality is standing on its head. We only look at it correctly when we imagine that with regard to a human being, it is standing on its head. With regard to animals, it's somewhat different, as we'll see in the course of these lectures. Now, why do I say the agricultural individuality is standing on its head? I say this because what is in the immediate vicinity to the earth, the air, water vapors, and warmth in which we live and breathe, and from which the plants also get their outer warmth, air, and water, this corresponds, in fact, to the human being's abdominal organs. Conversely, everything that happens below ground has an effect on plant growth that is similar to the effect that our head has on our body. Most notably during childhood, but also to some extent throughout life. A lively interchange is constantly taking place between what is above ground and what is below ground. In addition, we can say that the above ground activity is directly dependent on the Moon, Mercury, and Venus, as they support and modify the influence of the Sun. Consider this, for the time being, as a localization of the planetary influences. These so-called near-Earth planets have an effect on everything above the surface of the soil. In contrast, the distant planets, those beyond the Sun's orbit, work on everything beneath the soil and support those influences that the Sun exercises from below. As far as plant growth is concerned, we must look underground for the effects of the distant heavens, and above ground for the effects of the Earth's more immediate environment. Thus, what comes from the expanses of the universe and affects plant growth does not work directly through direct radiation, but by first being absorbed by the ground and then radiated upward. Beneficial or detrimental influences on plant growth that come from the ground are actually cosmic influences radiating back upward. On the other hand, the direct radiation at work in the air and water above the ground is stored up above and takes effect from there. This interacts with the effect that the inner constitution of the ground has on the plant growth. Later, we will have to widen this picture to include the effects on animals. To begin with, what we meet in the soil are all the effects that depend on the most distant reaches of the universe, insofar as these concern the earth. There we find what we commonly call sand and rocks. Sand and rocks, although impervious to water and said to contain no nutrients, are actually no less important for plant growth than the other factors that are relevant. They are, in fact, extremely important for the processes of growth because they convey forces from the furthest reaches of the universe. Unlikely as it may seem, it is especially by means of the silica-containing sand that the life ether and chemical ether, as we can call them, first enter into the soil and then take effect as they stream back upward. The extent to which the soil itself becomes alive and develops its own chemistry depends primarily on the sandy component of the soil. The conditions encountered by plant roots in the soil are greatly influenced by the extent to which the cosmic life and cosmic chemistry are collected by the rock and stone, which for this purpose need to be present only at considerable depths. Whenever plant growth is studied, it is important to know the geological stratum beneath the plants. And with plants whose roots are of a particular interest or importance, we should never forget that silica is indispensable, even if it is present only in the depths. Silica, thank God, is very widespread on the earth. 47 to 48% of everything consists of silica in the form of silicic acid and other silica compounds. So we can almost always count on enough silica being present to have the desired effect. The next thing to consider is how the forces brought into relationship with the plant roots by silica can be led up through the plant. These influences must stream upward. There must be a constant interplay between what is drawn in from the universe through silica and what goes on up there in the belly, which also nourishes the head down below. Although the head must be provided for out of the universe, it must also truly interact with what is occurring in the belly up above. What is collected down below from the cosmos must always be able to stream upward, and the presence of clay in the soil makes this possible. Substances like clay support the upward flow of the effects of the cosmic entities in the ground. Once we get down to practice, knowing this will help us deal with clay soils or sandy soils in accordance with the kind of crop we want to grow there. But first we need to know what is really going on. However else clay may be described, however else we must treat it so that it becomes fertile, all this is of secondary importance. The primary thing we need to know is that clay promotes the upward stream of the cosmic factor. But this cosmic upward stream is not the only thing to be considered. Everything going on in the belly, in the air, above the ground, constitutes a kind of digestion for the plants. And this digestion, I will call it the terrestrial or earthly factor, must be drawn down into the ground so that a real interplay takes place. All the forces and fine homeopathic substances produced by means of the water and air above ground are drawn down by the soil's greater or lesser content of lime. It is the lime in the soil and the presence of calcareous substances in homeopathic doses just above the soil's surface that serve to draw this terrestrial factor down into the ground. You see, everything will look quite different once we have a real science of these things in place of the meaningless talk that currently passes for science. Then we will be able to give exact details about these things. Then we will know, for instance, that there is a huge difference between the above-ground warmth that is in the domain of Sun, Venus, Mercury, and Moon, and the kind of warmth that is active below ground, which is under the influence of Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars. As far as planets are concerned, we can describe the former as leaf and blossom warmth, and the latter as root warmth. These two kinds of warmth are totally different, so different that we might even say the above ground warmth is dead, while the underground warmth is living. The underground warmth includes a definite life principle. Something living is inherent in it, especially in winter. If we human beings had to experience the warmth that is active down below, we would all become exceedingly stupid, because in order to be smart, we need to have dead warmth around our bodies. As soon as warmth is drawn into the earth by means of the lime in the soil, indeed, wherever outer warmth passes over into inner warmth, this warmth becomes slightly enlivened. We are aware today of a difference between the air that is above ground and the air that is below ground. But we do not take into account the fact that warmth, too, is different above and below the Earth's surface. We know that the air below ground contains more carbon dioxide, while the air above ground contains more oxygen. But we really don't know why. The reason is that the air, too, takes on a slight degree of vitality when it is absorbed into the Earth. It is the same with both warmth and air. They are both slightly enlivened when they are absorbed into the earth. It is different, however, with water and with the solid earth element. Both of these become even more dead inside the earth than they are outside it. But in losing something of their outer vitality, they free themselves from what is immediately above the earth's surface and become receptive to the forces coming from the most distant parts of the universe. In our present epoch, the time between January 15th and February 15th is the time when it is easiest for them to be independent of the Earth's immediate surroundings and come under the influence of the distant cosmic forces that are within the Earth. These are things that will eventually become recognized as exact indications. For the mineral substances, midwinter is the time when the strongest formative forces, the strongest crystallizing forces, can develop within the earth. That is when the inner nature of the earth has the characteristic of being least reliant on itself, on its mineral masses, and most under the influence of the crystal-forming forces from the widths of the universe. The situation is this. The mineral substances of the earth have the greatest desire to be crystallized at the end of January. And the deeper down you go, the stronger is their desire to become pure and crystalline. This is the time when what's going on in the mineral kingdom is most neutral as far as plant growth is concerned, when the plants are most self-absorbed in the earth and least exposed to the mineral substances. On the other hand, for a period of time, before and after, especially before, when the minerals are just getting ready to become formed and crystalline, that is when the minerals radiate forces that are of particular importance for plant growth. Thus we can say, during the months of November and December, there is a time when what is beneath the surface of the earth has a particularly strong effect on plant growth. And so the question becomes, how can we put this knowledge to use? People will someday realize how important it is to take advantage of such things in order to be able to regulate the growth of plants. Let me remark here that if we are dealing with a soil that does not carry these influences upward during the winter, as it should, it is good to furnish the soil with some clay, the dosage of which I will indicate later. With the clay, we prepare the soil to conduct the crystalline force upward for the plant growth above the earth's surface. This force of crystallization, which is already apparent in the crystallizing snow, reaches its peak intensity in January or February and gets stronger and more intense the further down into the earth one goes. So you see, we can derive some very positive and truly helpful hints from information that initially seems far-fetched. Without such information, we would just be experimenting in the dark. We must realize that a given area of farmland, together with what's beneath the soil, forms an individuality that also exists in time, and that the life of the soil is especially strong in winter, while in a certain sense it tends to die down in summer. Now, especially in connection with agriculture, there is one thing I have often mentioned among anthroposophists that is extremely important to understand. It entails knowing under which conditions the universe and its forces can work upon earthly things. In order to understand this, let us take the seed-forming process as our starting point. We usually think of the seed from which the embryo develops as having an extremely complicated molecular structure, and we set great store in being able to understand it in all its complexity. We imagine molecules as having certain definite structures, simpler in the